Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 922. The Trip and Confabanda Part 5, Walking the Snake with the Donalds, subtitled The Underground Reich Comes into Plain View, Part 3. This program is being recorded on September 9th of the year 2016. I said in the introduction to For the Record 921 that that program would be the conclusion to the Trippenkampfverbande series. That is a word that I made up. Trippen, of course, derived from Donald Trump, and Verbande is a term that is used or was used perhaps still used for German infantry units. In part four, we ran out of time. For one thing, I had to attenuate and compress a number of elements that I would have preferred not to, and leave a few things for the description that I would have preferred not to. And I think those are things that need to be discussed at greater length. Plus, we are going to wrap things up in this program with a very important transitional element to the next program, in which we are going to basically achieve a wider focus. We're going to dolly the camera out, so to speak, and take a look at the high-profile hacks that have been going on. The hack of the Democratic National Committee servers, some of the information of which wound up on WikiLeaks on the eve of the Democratic National Convention. We're going to take a look at the NSA hacks as well. Both hacks are being attributed to, quote, guess who, Russia, unquote, and, quote, Guccifer 2.0. In fact, the evidence suggests that it was not Russia at all, but rather, I suspect it was Team Snowden, meaning WikiLeaks and other people associated with Snowden. WikiLeaks is part of what I call the Conga Line Ops, and For the Record 885. Team Assange, so to speak, is inextricably linked with Team Snowden, and it is a fascist milieu and an underground Reich milieu. One of the nicknames I applied to Snowden was the Obverse Oswald, and we're going to be taking a look at the framing, and I believe that is just what it is, of Russia for the hacks, and then we are going to take a look at, we're going to compare that with the painting of Oswald Red. One of the themes that I think could be said to apply to this program is something that I have spoken about so many times in the past, and that is the quote from political comedian Mort Saul, one of my role models, frankly, one of the people who inspired me to do what I do. In his autobiography, Heartland, he noted that, quote, how many lies can you allow yourself to believe before you belong to the lie? And I think that is a question that we all need to be asking ourselves, and we're going to be taking a look at what passes for journalism in this country at this point in time. Although I have some reservations about Hillary Clinton, I cannot recall offhand seeing a human being, not even her husband, being demonized in the way that she is being demonized, and incredibly unfairly. I'm going to put some links in the description to this show, because I'm not sure that we're going to have time to go into it. But the, quote, email scandal, unquote, is a good example. Not only did she not break any laws, she was advised by Colin Powell that she could do what she did. And the whole email trove amounted to 30,000 emails, 12 of which contained classified material, none of which were sent by her, and all of the classified material was subsequently deemed to be classified by the CIA. 12 emails out of 30,000 is a 0.36% margin of error, and I will toss the gauntlet down to anyone in the audience or any institution on earth to exceed a 0.36% margin of error. And yet, we're hearing all about Hillary Clinton's email scandal, blah, 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 and the Clinton Foundation, which we are going to talk about at greater length. The part of the title of this program is Walking the Snake with the Donald. The Donald is a nickname that was applied to Donald Trump by his ex-wife Ivana. And Walking the Snake, of course, applies, that is a reference to the Nazi tracked serpent's walk that we have spoken about so many times in the past. Because what that tracked, allegedly a novel, I think it is actually a blueprint, a manifesto for what is going to be done in the future. It is about the Third Reich and the SS going underground at the end of World War II, which they did, building up their economic muscle, which they did, buying into the opinion-forming media, which they had done, and we're going to look at subsets of that. And then eventually, after the U.S. is decimated by a series of WMD terrorist attacks and martial law is declared, the SS and the underground Reich, which have infiltrated the military, take over. A key portion of the Nazi takeover in the mid-21st century that is portrayed in Serpent's Walk involves manipulating public opinion through gaining financial control or economic control of the opinion forming media. We've talked about that in the past, and we are going to talk about that again in this program. And for the record, 921. We not only look at the fact that Trump has been manifesting rhetorical techniques that were, if not pioneered, certainly applied with an unprecedented degree of success by Adolf Hitler. And we've also looked at the fact that Donald Trump had, in fact, studied Adolf Hitler's speeches. We're going to use as a jumping-off point here an element of continuity from the last program. And at the end of the show will be yet another element of continuity, taking a look at the Obverse Oswald and the Trump political milieu, which evolved from the libertarian milieu of Ron Paul, David Duke, the Ludwig von Mises Institute, and the neo-Confederate movement. Exactly what I cited as the foundational political elements of Eddie the Friendly Spook Snowden, the Peach Fuzz Fascist, the Obverse Oswald. One of the very few people to cite what Trump has been doing with the profound acquiescence of the news media was former CNN host Soledad O'Brien. And there was some information about that in the Raw Story blog of September 4th of 2016. An article by David Edwards, E-D-W-A-R-D-S. Soledad O'Brien eviscerates CNN. You have normalized white supremacy with shoddy Trump reporting. And that is exactly what has been done. We read much of this story in our last program, and we're going to come back to it right now. eclipsing, or not eclipsing, but telescoping some of what Ms. O'Brien said. If you look at Hillary Clinton's speech, where she basically pointed out that what Donald Trump has done, actually quite well, has normalized white supremacy, O'Brien explained to CNN host Brian Stelter on Sunday. I think she made a very good argument, almost like a lawyer, parenthetically. She is a lawyer. Here are ways in which he has actually worked to normalize conversations that many people find hateful. I've seen on air white supremacists being interviewed because they are Trump delegates, she noted, and they do a 5-minute segment, the first minute or so, talking about what they believe as white supremacists. So you have normalized that. The former CNN host argued that the question that journalists should be asking is if Trump is, quote, softening the ground for people who are white supremacists, who are white nationalists, who would self-identify that way to feel comfortable with their views being brought into the national discourse to the point where they can do a 5-minute interview happily on national television. And the answer is yes, clearly, she said. And there is lots of evidence of that. The article is included in its entirety in the written description for this program. Continuing with this, O'Brien observed that cable news outlets were effectively being rewarded for bad behavior. So hateful speech really brings an interested, angry audience, she noted. This is genius. We should do this more often. What shall we do when this election is over? We're going to have to think about ways to really rile people up, make them angry, and divide them, unquote. Because that is something that cable news, frankly, and everybody can cover really well, O'Brien lamented. So I find it very frustrating. I believe Trump was overcovered at the beginning. Now, it is he said, she said all the time. We have lost context. We actually don't even cover the details of something. We just cover the back and forth of it. It's funny to watch if it weren't our own country and our own government actually operating. And in Serpent's Walk, the back cover of that book, by the way, it is put out by National Vanguard Books, the publishing arm of the National Alliance. That is one of the Nazi groups that was represented by Glenn Greenwald, who paved the way for those groups to avoid civil litigation for acts of racist terror and violence that are inspired by the works they publish. And they publish those works to do exactly that. Serpent's Walk is published by someone who writes under the name of Randolph D. Calverhall. It was copyrighted in 1991. And on the back cover it says, it assumes that Hitler's warrior elite, the SS, didn't give up their struggle for a white world when they lost the Second World War. Instead, their survivors went underground and adopted some of their tactics, some of the tactics of their enemies. They began building their economic muscle and buying into the opinion-forming media. A century after the war, they are ready to challenge the Democrats and Jews for the hearts and minds of white Americans who have begun to have their fill of government-enforced multiculturalism and, quote, equality, unquote.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Another of the points that is made in Serpent's Walk, and I will include the passage in the text, is that the process of turning the minds of white Americans around is one that is done very gradually. I concluded For the Record 921 with another reading of They Thought They Were Free. And one of the things that a German university professor mentioned was that the whole process was very gradual and that each step was not that much greater than what went before. And so if you didn't protest at step A, why protest at step B? And I am encouraging people to take a good look at what is going on. Solobat O'Brien is one of the very few to take note of what the media are doing. And gradually, what I have referred to as the underground Reich is emerging overground and is emerging into plain view. At some point, for a takeover, an underground movement must move overground and become overt and relatively out front. That is what we are seeing. And even if Donald Trump does not win, I would cite the example of Barry Goldwater in 1964, who was viewed as a complete wacko within a very short period of time. The Republican Party as a whole had basically moved to where Barry Goldwater was in 64, and by the time Barry Goldwater died, he was well to the left of where the Republican Party is now. There are a number of things involved in the media's, frankly, scandalous coverage of this campaign. Part of it, and Paul Krugman has noted this in the New York Times, is that they feel compelled to be fair. Well, there are really two sides of things. Solobat O'Brien has noted that in the article I just read. Krugman elsewhere has written that one might characterize this as the earth is flat. Both sides have some points. Trying to make out an outright fascist political party, and that is what the Republicans are, to be no different than the Democrats or simply shades of gray, is simply a grotesque fantasy. The so-called progressive sector is profoundly guilty of the same thing. I am so tired of hearing so-called progressives say that, well, there's no difference between the Republicans and the Democrats, so I have to vote green or libertarian or whatever. And then when the Republicans get in and appoint the federal judiciary, and they in turn roll back any limits on campaign spending, as the Republican-dominated Supreme Court did in the Citizens United decision, or when they roll back the Voting Rights Act, as the Republican-dominated Supreme Court did in a recent ruling about Shelby County, Alabama, then the progressives lament that as though this weren't something that they helped to bring about in the first place, and in fact they did. It reminds me of the German Communist Party in 1932. They asked their members to vote for Hitler because at one level they felt that having the Nazis in power would drive the German political spectrum to the left, and also because, as they put it, the social democrats are worse than Hitler, unquote. Famous last words. I think the so-called progressive sector in this country is guilty of something very similar. Beyond that, there is the issue of herd instinct. People are basically herd animals. They go along with what their compatriots are doing. People are hardwired for that. Beyond that, there is the economic and political fact of life that derives from Mortsall's axiom. How many lies can you allow yourself to believe before you belong to the lie? When you have a news medium, whether it is commercial or non-commercial, you have people who are earning their living by working for it. They are getting paid, and once they have gone on record as taking a particular position, for them to fundamentally reverse their position is not viewed as professionally acceptable. It won't advance the firm, so to speak. And we're going to take a look in this program at how that economic control is wielded. Paul Krugman on Monday, Labor Day, September 5th, had a column about the unfair coverage of Hillary Clinton. He compared this to the coverage that was afforded Al Gore in the 2000 election when George W. Bush was up there lying like a big dog. The media basically made out that, well, Gore was fudging things and, you know, W. really wasn't such a bad guy at all. I'll let Krugman's words speak for themselves. In Hillary Clinton Gets Gored by Paul Krugman from the New York Times of September 5th of 2016. Americans of a certain age who follow politics and policy closely still have vivid memories of the 2000 election. Bad memories, and not just because the man who lost the popular vote somehow ended up in office. For the campaign leading up to that endgame was nightmarish, too. You see, one candidate, George W. Bush, by the way, whose father, CIA headquarters, is named, was dishonest in a way that was unprecedented in U.S. politics. Most notably, he proposed big tax cuts for the rich while insisting in raw denial of arithmetic that they were targeted for the middle class. These campaign lies presaged what would happen during his administration, an administration that, let us not forget, took America to war on false pretenses. Yet throughout the campaign, most media coverage gave the impression that Mr. Bush was a bluff, straightforward guy while portraying Al Gore, whose policy proposals added up and whose critiques of the Bush plan were completely accurate as slippery and dishonest. Mr. Gore's mendacity was supposedly demonstrated by trivial anecdotes, none significant, some of them simply false. No, he never claimed to have invented the Internet, but the image stuck. And right now I and many others have the sick, sinking feeling that it's happening again. True, there aren't many efforts to pretend that Donald Trump is a paragon of honesty, but it's hard to escape the impression that he's being graded on a curve. If he manages to read from a teleprompter without going off script, he's being presidential. If he seems to suggest that he wouldn't round up all 11 million undocumented immigrants right away, he's moving into the mainstream. And many of his multiple scandals, like what appear to be clear payoffs to state attorneys general to back off investigating Trump University, get remarkably little attention. Meanwhile, we have the presumption that anything Hillary Clinton does must be corrupt, most spectacularly illustrated by the increasingly bizarre coverage of the Clinton Foundation. Step back for a moment and think about what that foundation is about. When Bill Clinton left office, he was a popular, globally respected figure. What should he have done with that reputation? Raising large sums for a charity that saves the lives of poor children sounds like a pretty reasonable, virtuous course of action. And the Clinton Foundation is, by all accounts, a big force for good in the world. For example, Charity Watch, an independent watchdog, gives it an A rating, better than the American Red Cross. Now, any operation that raises and spends billions of dollars creates the potential for conflicts of interest. You could imagine the Clintons using the foundation as a slush fund to reward their friends, or alternatively, Mrs. Clinton using her positions in public office to reward donors. So it was right and appropriate to investigate the foundation's operations to see if there were any improper quid pro quos. As reporters like to say, the sheer size of the foundation, quote, raises questions, unquote. But nobody seems willing to accept the answers to those questions, which are very clearly no. Consider the big AP report suggesting that Mrs. Clinton's meetings with foundation donors while Secretary of State indicates, quote, her possible ethics challenges if elected president, unquote. Given the tone of the report, you might have expected to read about meetings with, say, brutal foreign dictators or corporate fat cats facing indictment followed by questionable actions on their behalf. But the prime example the AP actually offered was of Mrs. Clinton meeting with Muhammad Yunus, Y-U-N-U-S, a winner of the Nobel Peace Prize who also happens to be a long-time personal friend. If that was the best the investigation could come up with, there was nothing there. So I would urge journalists to ask whether they are reporting facts or simply engaging in innuendo, and urge the public to read with a critical eye. If reports about a candidate talk about how something, quote, raises questions, unquote, creates, quote, shadows, unquote, or anything similar, be aware that these are all too often weasel words used to create the impression of wrongdoing out of thin air. And here's a pro tip. The best ways to judge a candidate's character are to look at what he or she has actually done and what policies he or she is proposing. Mr. Trump's record of bilking students, stiffing contractors, and more is a good indicator of how he would act as president. Mrs. Clinton's speaking style and body language aren't. George W. Bush's policy lies gave me a much better handle on who he was than all the up-close and personal reporting of 2000, and the contrast between Mr. Trump's policy incoherence and Mrs. Clinton's carefulness speaks volumes today. In other words, focus on the facts. America and the world can't afford another election tipped by innuendo. And by the way, today is September 9th. There is a good follow-up column by Paul Krugman that I will link to the description, the written description for this program. I would also note quickly and in passing that the Hillary is corrupt meme really got a lot of acceleration from the candidacy of Bernie Sanders, St. Bernard, who in 12 years in the Senate did not sponsor one significant piece of legislation. And he began repeating that, well, Hillary Clinton was running a money laundering operation. And now I suspect he is feeling a degree of regret because he has basically functioned like the sorcerer's apprentice, and a lot of his followers are running with what he had said. What his followers have not asked is why Karl Rove's American Crossroads, political action, super crossroads, why Karl Rove's American Crossroads super PAC was channeling money to St. Bernard early in the election, and how many of the anonymous small donations that St. Bernard received actually came from Karl Rove and the GOP or allied interests. Again, they never asked that question. Now, in politics, one wants to ask, who is paying the bills? And in For the Record 919, For the Record 920 and 921, actually 919, 920, and 921, I took a look at who has helped to finance Donald Trump's real estate operations, in addition to George Soros, who appears to have played a relatively small role, Deutsche Bank, and the Union Bank of Switzerland are involved, particularly Deutsche Bank. Who and what is Deutsche Bank? Reading now from Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, published in hardcover by Lyle Stewart, and available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website. And again, Paul Manning, a protege and colleague of Edward R. Murrow, who undertook this investigation at the encouragement of Edward R. Murrow.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Note here that the Borman Organization has been purchasing stock in major American corporations for many, many years. This gives them a great deal of say in what those corporations do. Deutsche Bank has been a major vehicle for the purchase of those stocks. So in addition to the profound Borman link to Deutsche Bank, the single greatest underwriter of Donald Trump's real estate investments. Note here that the Borman Group has a great deal of say in what major corporations do. When Borman gave the order for his representatives to resume purchases of American corporate stocks, it was usually done through the neutral countries of Switzerland and Argentina. From foreign exchange funds on deposit in Swiss banks and in Deutsche Südamerikanische Bank, the Buenos Aires branch of Deutsche Bank, large demand deposits were placed in the principal money center banks of New York City, National City, now Citibank, Chase, now Chase Manhattan, Manufacturers and Hanover, now Manufacturers Hanover Trust, Morgan Guaranty, and Irving Trust. Such deposits are interest-free, and the banks can invest this money as they wish, thus turning tidy profits for themselves. In return, they provide reasonable services such as the purchase of stocks and transfer or payment of money on demand by customers of Deutsche Bank, such as representatives of the Borman business organizations and Martin Borman himself, who has demand accounts in three New York City banks. They continue to do so. The German investment in American corporations from these sources exceeded $5 billion, and this book was published in 1981, and made the Borman economic structure a web of power and influence. The two German-owned banks of Spain, Banco Alemán Transatlántico, now named Banco Comercial Transatlántico, and Banco Germánico de la América del Sur, a subsidiary of Deutsche Bank, served to channel German money from Spain to South America, where further investments were made. The FBI file revealed, this is the FBI file on Martin Borman, the FBI file on Borman revealed that he had been banking under his own name from his office in Germany in Deutsche Bank of Buenos Aires since 1941. That he held one joint account with the Argentinian dictator Juan Perón, and on August 4th, 5th, and 14th, 1967, had written checks on demand accounts in First National City Bank Overseas Division of New York, the Chase Manhattan Bank, and Manufacturers Hanover Trust, all cleared through Deutsche Bank of Buenos Aires. That again in August of 1967. By the way, banking records are very good documentation. Phony autopsy evidence as was manufactured to demonstrate the death of Martin Borman in 1945 isn't. We've spoken about that in various programs, For the Record 604, and in For the Record 915, the second of my two interviews with Gerard Williams. In addition to the fact that Deutsche Bank is inextricably linked with the operations of Martin Borman, and that the Borman Group has enormous stock holdings in American corporations, enabling them to steer the direction of American corporations to a large extent. The Borman Group also operates in, they control corporate Germany as well. There also is text in the description for the Record 922 about the Borman operations with Union Bank of Switzerland. Recall that in the For the Record 918 and 919, we mentioned that Joseph P. Schmitz married to the sister of Columba Bush, Jeb Bush's wife, and the brother of Joseph E. Schmitz, one of Donald Trump's top foreign policy advisors, is a lawyer who handles many accounts for big German corporations. Corporate Germany, so to speak, is run by the Bormann Group. Reading once again from Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. Atop an organizational pyramid that dominates the industry of West Germany, this was in 1981 before East and West Germany were reunited, atop an organizational pyramid that dominates the industry of West Germany through banks, voting rights enjoyed by majority shareholders in significant cartels, and the professional input of a relatively young leadership group of lawyers, investment specialists, bankers, and industrialists, Bormann is satisfied that he achieved his aim of helping the fatherland back on its feet. To ensure continuity of purpose and direction, a close watch is maintained on the profit statements and management reports of corporations under its control elsewhere. This leadership group of 20, which is in fact a board of directors, is chaired by Bormann, but power has shifted to the younger men who will carry on the initiative that grew from that historic meeting in Strasbourg on August 10th of 1944. Old Heinrich Müller, chief of security for the NSDAP in South America, is the most feared of all, having the power of life and death over those deemed not to be acting in the best interests of the organization. Some still envision a Fourth Reich. What will not pass ever is the economic influences of the Bormann organization, whose commercial directives are obeyed almost without question by the highest echelons of West German finance and industry. All orders come from the shareholders in South America, I have been told by a spokesman for Martin Bormann. So in addition to buying up American media voices like Bertelsmann that we have spoken about, in addition to being able to wield tremendous influence in American corporations, the Bormann Group controls corporate Germany. And yet another way of influencing the media is the allocation or withholding of advertising contracts by those major corporations, depending on what a media voice chooses to print or broadcast, or what they elect not to print or broadcast. And with Deutsche Bank being the single biggest financial backer of Donald Trump, and with the profound Bormann influence with Deutsche Bank, we should consider the role of corporate Germany and perhaps also big American corporations in which the Bormann Group holds major stock participation in influencing advertising. In the book Germany Plots with the Kremlin that we accessed at considerable length in For the Record 918, there is a passage that is from a New York Herald Tribune article authored by Dorothy Thompson. This was published at the end of May of 1941, a few months before the U.S. went to May 31st, rather, of 1940. In Germany Plots with the Kremlin, I've read this before, the blueprint for a German-dominated all-European economic union is set forth at considerable length, and I have this again in the written description for the show. The Germans, and this is Dorothy Thompson writing on May 31st of 1940, the Germans have a clear plan of what they intend to do in case of victory. I believe that I know the essential details of that plan. I've heard it from a significant number of important Germans to credit its authenticity. Germany's plan is to make a customs union of Europe with complete financial and economic control centered in Berlin. By the way, that has now happened. It's called the EU and the associated EMU. Continuing. This will create at once the largest free trade area and the largest planned economy in the world. In Western Europe alone, there will be an economic unity of 400 million persons. By the way, she was writing in 1940 here. To these will be added the resources of the British, French, Dutch, and Belgian empires. These will be pooled in the name of Europa Germanica. The Germans count upon political power following economic power and not vice versa. Territorial changes do not concern them because there will be no France or England except as language groups. Little immediate concern is felt concerning political organizations. No nation will have the control of its own financial or economic system or of its customs. The Nazification of all countries will be accomplished by economic pressure. In all countries, contacts have been established long ago with sympathetic businessmen and industrialists. As far as the U.S. is concerned, the planners of the World Germanica laugh off the idea of any armed invasion. They say that it will be completely unnecessary to take military action against the U.S. to force it to play ball with this system. Here, as in every other country, they have established relations with numerous industries and commercial organizations. Parenthetically, I would note that the Bush family and Donald Trump are clearly among those. Trump, of course, in relatively more recent times, although who knows about Fred Trump, his father. Beginning again with this last sentence. Here, as in every other country, they have established relations with numerous industries and commercial organizations to whom they will offer advantages in cooperation with Germany. Certain conditions will have to be met. No orders will be taken from or given by personalities unfavorably regarded by the Nazis. No advertising contracts will be placed with newspapers directed by or publishing the work of pro-Ally or anti-Nazi editors or writers. The German planners predict a stampede of the South to collaborate with this system. This stampede will be fostered and directed by their agents. Note again, no orders will be taken from or given by personalities unfavorably regarded by the Nazis. No advertising contracts will be placed with newspapers directed by or publishing the work of pro-Ally or anti-Nazi editors or writers. And I think we can extend that to broadcast outlets as well. I want to note in this regard a comment in the AWL blog. Someone noted that BMW withholds advertising money from the Atlantic magazine when they ran stories about World War II or the Holocaust. I worked at the Atlantic when Wallace wrote a terrific feature for them about talk radio. According to our managing editor, he was a sweetheart to deal with. Whenever the books section reviewed something about World War II or the Holocaust, which was often, BMW pulled their ads for that issue. They were just very sensitive about it, given their history. I was in the art department, so I couldn't tell you any details. It just became a running joke. Oh, Ben has reviewed another World War II book. Ad sales will be pissed, unquote. Well, noting who controls BMW, I think they're sensitive about their history, all right. They are certainly part of the Bormann Network. From Bloomberg News of January 28th of 2013, an article by David DeJong, DeJong. Nazi Goebbels' stepchildren are hidden billionaires. In the spring of 1945, Harold Quandt, Quandt, a 23-year-old officer in the German Luftwaffe, was being held as a prisoner of war by Allied forces in the Libyan port city of Benghazi when he received a farewell letter from his mother, Magda Goebbels, the wife of Nazi propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels. Skipping down. Quandt was released from captivity in 1947. 7 years later, he and his half-brother Herbert, Harold was the only remaining child from Magda Goebbels' first marriage, would inherit the industrial empire built by their father, Günther Quandt, which had produced Mauser firearms and anti-aircraft missiles for the Third Reich's war machine. Among their most valuable assets at the time was a stake in car manufacturer Daimler AG, manufacturer of the Mercedes-Benz, of course. They bought a part of Bayerische Motorenwerke AG BMW a few years later. And talking about some of the descendants of Harold Quandt, skipping down again, the four sisters inherited about 1.5 billion Deutsche Marks after the death of their mother, Inga in 1978. That translates into about $760 million, a lot of money in 1978. Beginning again, the four sisters inherited about 1.5 billion Deutsche Marks, or $760 million, after the death of their mother, Inga, in 1978. According to the family's sanctioned biography, the Quants, they managed their wealth through the Harold Quandt Holding Company, GmbH, a Bob Homburg, Germany-based family investment company, and trust named after their father. The family wants to stay private, and that is an acceptable situation for me. And again, they are the dominant stockholder in BMW. BMW also controls Audi as well, and they have major stakes in Volkswagen and, of course, in Daimler. So basically, this is a company that has a major, major influence in the American automobile market through those cars, Audi, BMW, Mercedes-Benz, and Volkswagen. And note that BMW would pull ads when the Atlantic magazine ran reviewed a book about World War II or the Holocaust. I don't think it is a reach at all to see the slanting of American journalistic coverage as stemming in part not only from the influence of corporate Germany through the granting or withholding of advertising contracts, but also the purchase of American media outlets by Bertelsmann or other German firms, Axel Springer, for example, an extremely right-wing German firm, owns Investors Business Daily. Also, the influence of the Bormann Group through major stockholdings in American corporations also needs to be factored in. Something of a transitional element to the next program that I'm going to be doing. We're going to dolly the camera out and to get a wider view. And for the record, 917, I noted that WikiLeaks has basically emerged as more or less the online dirty tricks branch of the Donald Trump campaign. Julian Assange is apparently in direct contact with Roger Stone, a key Donald Trump campaign functionary and a Republican dirty tricks specialist who has been active since the Watergate scandals surrounding Richard Nixon. I have noted in For the Record 885 and in other programs that basically Team Assange is at one with Team Snowden. The WikiLeaks operation and the Snowden op are part and parcel to the same thing. One of the major points that I have been making about WikiLeaks and about Edward Snowden and the elements around them is that they are as far to the right as you can get. And For the Record 756, For the Record 758 and 9, I noted the profound links between Edward Snowden and what I call the Palestinian Libertarian Organization. Ron Paul was not only Edward Snowden's presidential candidate of choice, Snowden contributed money to his campaign. The chief legal counsel for Ron Paul's 2012 campaign, a guy named Bruce Fine, was the first attorney for Edward Snowden and is the attorney for the Snowden family, having formed a nonprofit with Lon Snowden, Snowden's father. Julian Assange is also a big fan of Ron and Rand Paul. Ron Paul's super PAC was capitalized primarily by Peter Thiel, who is in turn a Donald Trump delegate. It should not surprise us to see Julian Assange and WikiLeaks working on behalf of Donald Trump at all. And in our next program, we're going to take a look at the high-profile hacks, both of the DNC servers, attributed almost certainly incorrectly to Russia, and now the new NSA hacks and feeds as well, also being attributed almost certainly incorrectly to Russia as well. We're going to take a look at those hacks and the apparent online false flag operation that they have become, that they really are. And we're going to take a look at that in terms of Eddie Snowden.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
We are now, there is a very important article, and we're going to reprise this in For the Record 923 in the Washington Post of September 2nd of 2016. The article is by Matthew Sheffield. It's called, Where Did Donald Trump Get His Radicalized Rhetoric? From Libertarians, by Matthew Sheffield. And this article is making the point that Donald Trump has evolved from exactly the forces that I identified in the background, really not in the background, but at the foundation of the political orientation and operations of WikiLeaks and Julian Assange and Eddie the Friendly Spook. The article reads in part as follows. Last month, Hillary Clinton delivered a similar message in a speech linking Trump to the white nationalist political movement known as the alt-right. This is not conservatism as we have known it, she asserted. According to Clinton and many conservative intellectuals who oppose Trump, the conspiratorial winking at racists campaign he has been running represents a novel departure from Republican politics. I would argue that, no, it is a logical development of Republican politics. That's not quite true, though. Trump's style and positions, endorsing and consorting with 9/11 truthers, promoting online racists, using fake statistics, draw on a now obscure political strategy called paleo-libertarianism, which was once quite popular among some Republicans, especially former presidential candidate Ron Paul. Skipping down. Formerly Senator Rand Paul may be his father's political heir, but there's no question that the paranoid and semi-racialist mean frequently favored by Trump originates in the fevered swamp that the elder Paul dwelled in for decades. Skipping down. Mainstream libertarians have been agonizing over this legacy among themselves for some time, hoping that either the elder or younger Paul would definitively denounce the movement's racialist past, but no such speech has ever come. Instead, the paleo-libertarian strategy concocted decades ago as a way to push for minimal government threatens to replace right-wing libertarianism with white nationalism. The figure whose ideas unify Pauline libertarians and today's Trumpists is the late Murray Rothbard, an economist who co-founded the Cato Institute, by the way, with whom Glenn Greenwald consorts, and is widely regarded as the creator of libertarianism. Nowadays, many libertarians like to portray their ideology as one that somehow transcends the left-right divide. But for Murray Rothbard, this was nonsense. Libertarianism, he argued, was nothing more than a restatement of the beliefs of the old right, which resolutely opposed the New Deal and any sort of foreign intervention in the early 20th century. Skipping down. There had always been some sympathy for racism and anti-Semitism among libertarians. The movement's House magazine Reason dedicated an entire issue in 1976 to historical revisionism, including Holocaust revisionism. It also repeatedly ran articles in defense of South Africa's then segregationist government, though by 2016, the magazine was running articles like Donald Trump enables racism. But it was Rothbard's founding of the Ludwig von Mises Institute in 1982 that enabled the fledgling political movement to establish affinity with the neo-Confederate Lost Cause movement. Almost immediately after its creation, the Mises Institute, headquartered in Auburn, Alabama, began publishing criticism of compulsory integration, attacks on Abraham Lincoln, and apologia for Confederate leaders. Institute scholars have also spoken to racist groups such as the League of the South. Rothbard even published a chapter in his book, The Ethics of Liberty, in which he said that, quote, the purely free society will have a flourishing free market in children, unquote, although he didn't specify the races of the children who might be sold. Skipping down. These and many other controversial views advocated by Mises writers make sense from a fanatical libertarian viewpoint, but they also originate in a political calculation Rothbard revealed in a 1992 essay lamenting the defeat of Republican white nationalist and former Ku Klux Klan leader David Duke in the 1991 Louisiana governor's race by a bipartisan coalition. Expanding on themes raised 2 years earlier by his longtime partner and friend, Llewellyn Lew Rockwell, an editor and fundraiser for libertarian causes, Rothbard argued that Duke's candidacy was vitally important because it made clear that the old America, unquote, had been overthrown by an updated 20th century coalition of throne and altar at its state church, unquote, of government officials, journalists, and social scientists. Besides commending Duke as an exemplar of the kind of candidate he was looking to support, Rothbard also invoked the exciting, unquote, former Senator Joe McCarthy of Wisconsin, not because of his economic views, because he was a brash populist prone to doing erratic things. Rothbard's description of McCarthy seems eerily similar to the campaign that Trump has been running, skipping down. All of these paleo-libertarian positions were offered in Duke's 1990 Senate campaign and 1991 gubernatorial campaign. But they were also offered by another politician Rothbard admired, Ron Paul, the Libertarian Party's presidential candidate in 1988. Rockwell would work closely with Duke and Paul, serving as Paul's congressional chief of staff until he left to found the Mises Institute with Rothbard. And we will be continuing with this analysis in For the Record 923. I would simply note that what this Washington Post article is noting is basically how Trump's campaign is the direct continuance and basically amplification of the themes of not only Ron Paul, but David Duke as well. David Duke and Ron Paul having networked for decades. The point that I'm going to be making is that this is the same political milieu that is at the foundation of Team Snowden and Team Assange, those two teams being one and the same, basically. And they are underground lake. And I think the probability is very strong that that team, the team of the obverse Oswald, Eddie the Friendly Spook Snowden, the Peach Fuzz Fascist, is behind the high-profile leaks of DNC and NSA, the online false flag operations being portrayed as authored by Russia. However, we will go back into that in For the Record 923. This concludes For the Record 922, The Trump and Confabanda Part 5, Walking the Snake with the Donald, The Underground Reich Comes into Plain View, Part 3. This is being recorded on September 9th, 2016. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.